too. Ben's leg was against hers now, maybe not consciously. His other leg was probably against Marcella's leg. Marcella in her little skirt and tights and heels. Marcella Boxman looked like she worked not for Loci or for Schrader Capital, but for Vogue. Distantly, Greer recognized her own envy of the way Marcella moved through the world. Marcella had Ben's interest, and she had survived Faith's criticism, and she would probably end up being a powerful figure of some kind. It was a good thing that the first summit was about power. Marcella could pick up some tips to hasten its inevitability in her own life. The group was laughing, and the back room of the bar heated up further. Greer was overexcited being there, and the talk got loud and louder, and then it peaked, and the mood became reflective and even weary. The drinks stopped coming, and the evening started to wind down. Ben and Marcella would now have part two of the evening, Greer thought, going home to one of their beds. And the other people in the group, did they have partners waiting too? Was Greer the only one who would be alone? "Time to tear ourselves away," said Helen. People started to get out their wallets to throw down money, but just then someone urgently said, "Faith," which didn't in and of itself mean anything, because Faith's name was always getting said, a constant, a heartbeat, a rumbling blurp in the water cooler. But then Greer looked up and saw Faith walking toward the table. Wallets went back into bags and pockets, for the night apparently wasn't over yet after all. "Faith, over here," called Bonnie. Around the back room, a few people at other tables looked up and whispered to one another. They smiled, and one person said approvingly, "Faith Frank!" Then everyone went back to their conversations. This was New York, where famous people drank from the same trough you did, and where, in the scheme of things, Faith wasn't all that famous. The long tables, pushed together, were filled to their maximum, but everyone squeezed even closer, and Greer found herself jammed further against Ben. She could feel the key ring in his pocket. Across from Greer, Faith sat down, and almost immediately a martini appeared before her, its glass perfectly beaded, extra olives in a pyramid at the bottom. "I'm very grateful for this," Faith said. "The world is so enormous, but if you have places where they know what you like to drink, then all is well." Everyone casually talked to her, but no one wanted to monopolize her. Greer noted the way Faith maneuvered her way along the table without actually moving, like a figure in a painting whose eyes follow you around the room. She said something to each person, sharing a sympathetic or amused expression. Greer had been talking to Kim when Faith broke in. Kim was telling her how women in a corporate environment were not always good to one another. "We have this woman upstairs who will go unnamed," Kim said. "She's a heavy hitter in VC and awful to other women. I hear stories all the time. I was in the elevator with her and she just stood there, staring at the door, not saying a word, not even hi. And I wanted to say to her, 'I know I'm just an assistant, but don't you know that we're supposed to be decent to each other? I totally get that you feel threatened because you've been made to feel this way. The ranks of women are kept really, really thin, so everyone feels that they're the only one allowed in, and they can't afford to be nice to other women.' Cunts," Greer thought. That is what Z called women who hated women. She remembered the song with those lyrics that Z had once sung. Suddenly, Faith said, "So, Greer, you're making friends here? Finding your way?" It was the drink, partly. That was what she thought later. It was the drink and the late hour and the coincidence that Greer had been thinking about Z at that exact moment. Of course, she'd been thinking about Z a lot all week because of her letter. Kim turned away, talking to Ifat and Evelyn and giving Greer a moment with Faith. Ben, on Greer's other side, was talking to someone at the next table. No one was listening to Faith and Greer. "I have a friend who wants to work here," Greer suddenly said to Faith, almost in a whisper. "She wants me to give you a letter that she wrote, telling you about herself. You met her with me back in college." "Ah," said Faith. But if I'm really being honest with myself, I know that there's a reason I haven't given it to you yet.
Okay.
I guess I really don't want her to work here.
She wouldn't do a good job?
I'm sure she'd do a terrific job. She's been an activist. She just puts herself out there. Plus, she was the one who told me about you in the beginning. She's wonderful. I just don't think I want to share this experience with anyone. I think I want it for myself.
Greer was waiting now for Faith to condemn her or absolve her. Greer's purse with the letter in it down at her feet beneath the table felt as dangerous as a nuclear suitcase.
I see, said Faith.
And do you know why that is?
I have an idea, Greer said. But if I say it out loud, I don't know how it's going to sound.
Try it.
My parents never knew how to be parents, Greer said, and Faith nodded. The house was always messy, and I felt like we were all boarders in a boarding house. We didn't eat together that much. They didn't really get involved in the particulars of my life, my schoolwork, my friends. None of it was very interesting to them. They had this idea about being alternative, but really I think they were mostly pretty marginal. They were potheads. They still are.
I'm very sorry, Faith said gravely. I wish someone had recognized what was going on and tried to help your family be more of a family. It must have been confusing. A child just wants to love her parents and be loved, and it seems like it should be simple to do that, but sometimes it's not.
Hearing the words in the past tense was kind of a revelation. That must have been confusing, Faith was saying, but it is no longer all that relevant. I think they were disappointed in me, Greer said. I was so different from them, but I wanted something more. She realized how easily she was speaking to Faith. It wasn't like the time in the ladies' room. I was very ambitious. I studied like crazy, she said, and I read novels day and night. I had a mission.
Which was?
Faith speared an olive in her drink, slid it between her teeth.
To absorb everything in the world.
But also to escape.
Makes sense.
So I'm not saying that this excuses what I feel about my friend working here, said Greer. But I think it's the truth. She would be shocked if she heard me saying that I didn't want her. She paused. She's going to ask me what happened either way, and I'll have to say something. Greer thought about it. I could tell her that I gave you the letter, but there were no jobs. If I did that, would it make me a terrible person?
Faith didn't answer, but just kept looking at her.
Greer, shall I read the letter and make a decision about whether your friend should come in for an interview? She asked gently. Greer couldn't answer.
Or do you just want to let it go?
I don't know.
Well, my offer to read it stands, Faith said. You can put it on my desk Monday. Or not.
Thank you, was all Greer could say, miserably. There was a silence, and Greer thought Faith was going to turn away, perhaps in disapproval, and talk to someone else. But instead, she said,
I like the way you try to figure things out, Greer. You're genuine and thoughtful, even about parts of yourself you're not proud of. Want to do some writing for me?
Sure, Greer said. I'd love it.
Good. We're going to have small events around the city in the months before the first summit. These will be media lunches and dinners. There will be maybe 25 guests, max. Very intimate. The speakers I have in mind are women who've experienced injustice firsthand and tried to do something. None of them are slick. None of them are used to public speaking. They're not going to be at our summits, but we want them for these small events, kind of like teasers. It's important that they really know what to say. And I think, having read your fine writing and hearing you talk tonight, that you'd be someone who could help them shape their words into something good.
That sounds excellent, said Greer. Thank you, Faith.
You're welcome. Done.
And that was it. Greer would write small speeches for Losai. In this way, she would make herself indispensable. The whole evening had been tremendous, even the difficult part when she'd confessed about the Z letter. Greer knew that the night would stay in her mind for a long time, and she would remember sitting at that long table drinking and chatting more and more easily with other people who wanted to do good in the world. And one of those people had been Faith. Faith, who approved of Greer. The approval was as soft as velvet, and the desire for that approval was also like velvet, a little vulgar. It didn't even matter, Greer thought, that nothing had happened tonight that would make Faith think what a special night this was. Faith wouldn't think, "I loved talking to that young Greer Kadetsky. I know that Greer had a moral choice to make about the letter her friend gave her to give to me, and I watched her struggle with it. She's finding her way, young Greer, and I was glad to be there to watch and to assist if I could. Tonight was a lovely night, a bracing night, a memorable night." No, Faith wouldn't think the night had been unusual at all. But Greer would. Just then, Bonnie Dempster said,
"Faith, what was that witty thing we chanted at the ERA march, remember?"
Faith turned to Bonnie and said,
"Did it go 1, 2, 3, 4?
And Bonnie said,
"Yes, it did, and what came next?"
To which Faith said,
"Oh, Bonnie, I have no idea whatsoever."
Then to everyone,
"Senior moment."
There was laughter. The letter from Z, still at the bottom of Greer's purse, instantly became less significant. At work again on Monday, Greer forgot about it. She literally did not think about it once, and Faith didn't mention it. Faith had a lot of demands on her time, a lot of people asking her questions, soliciting her advice, calling her up, emailing her at all hours. A few days later, when the fact of the letter suddenly struck Greer again, she thought that it was too late now. Too much time had passed. Faith had probably forgotten all about it, and Greer should just let it drop. That was what she told herself. That night, though, Z called from her childhood bedroom in Scarsdale, where she was sitting beneath her old posters of the Spice Girls and Kim Gordon of Sonic Youth and endangered baby animals crouching in tundra or field or forest.
"So, did you get a chance to give the letter to Faith?" she asked.
Greer paused, sickened, madly thinking.
"Sorry to say," Greer said. "There are no jobs there."
"Oh," said Z. "That's too bad. I know it was a long shot."
"Did she say anything about what I wrote?"
"No, sorry."
"No worries," said Z, a joke between them. Then, "I appreciated that you tried. I've got to get out of this law firm soon somehow."
A confession to Faith. Then a non-action, then a lie. That was the sequence, and then it was done. Greer wondered afterward if everyone had a certain degree of awfulness inside them. There were moments when you idly glanced into the toilet or into a tissue after you'd used it and suddenly remembered that this was what you carried around inside you all the time. This was what was always waiting to be let out. When she got off the phone, the letter went into a bottom drawer of her dresser. She wondered exactly what it said, though she would never read it, and she would never tell anyone else what she had done. Only Faith knew. The following day, when Greer arrived at work, she found a folder from Ifat on her desk containing printouts about the women who were coming to give talks at the small media lunches and dinners. Over the next couple of months, these women came into the office one after another to be interviewed by Greer. They told her their stories about being harassed or denied equal pay or the chance to play sports and trying to do something about it. Once they started talking and realized how carefully Greer was listening, they talked more openly. What the stories had in common was a deep and grinding sense of unfairness. Unfair could burn you up. Sometimes the women seemed entirely burned up the minute they started talking, but other times
They just seemed defeated, and they cried into their hands as they sat in the conference room with Greer. Their faces became congested, and they were so exposed that she wanted to shield them, knowing they were surrounded by glass and that some greenish, blurred version of them could be seen by everyone walking past. When they cried, she sometimes cried a little too, but she never stopped taking notes or running the little digital recorder. She learned she didn't need to say much. It was better if she didn't. Later on, after they left, Greer sat down and wrote the speech as if they were telling it into her ear. The first speech Greer wrote was for Beverly Cox, who worked in a shoe factory upstate where the men were paid more, and on top of that where the women were degraded and harassed, and they all had to work together inside a hot box roiling with fumes. The product they made there was high-end shoes for wealthy women, all pointed toe and weaponized heel. Greer sat in her cubicle, playing back a tape with headphones on, listening to Beverly haltingly describe standing in a line of women making heels, while across the way, a group of men made soles and were paid more for it. After Beverly discovered the discrepancy and complained to the manager, she was harassed and threatened by male co-workers. They changed the lock on her locker so she couldn't open it. They slashed her tires. They left threatening and pornographic messages at her workstation. The smells of leather and glue became associated with degradation. They were in her head and on her clothes all the time. The lawyer she called for help put her in touch with the foundation. "I'd get out of my car in the parking lot each morning and walk into that factory like I was walking a plank," Beverly had said. And then she burst into tears, and Greer had said, "Take as long as you need." On the tape, for a very long stretch, all that could be heard were Beverly's scared, shaky breaths, and once in a while Greer saying, "It's okay. I think it's great that you're speaking about this. I really admire you." And then Beverly had said, "Thank you," and blown her nose loudly. Then there was more silence. Greer didn't try to shorten it. A person needed to take her time when she talked about what had been so hard for her. Greer sat in her cubicle, listening to the breathing, and then again, the talking. When Beverly delivered the speech at lunch in an Italian restaurant in Midtown to a small crowd of local media, everyone was quiet, appalled. Of course, it was exciting for Greer to be the one who had shaped the speech, and to know that Faith, who was also in the room, knew it too. Faith came over to Greer afterward and lightly whispered, "Nailed it." But what excited Greer now wasn't only Faith's praise. While it would always feel extraordinary to know she had the admiration of Faith Frank, what also excited Greer was that the speeches she was writing might give the women who delivered them a chance to be ambitious too, as ambitious as she was. Winter dissolved, and the office hummed louder, and the beta lights burned longer, and perhaps even greener, and work often extended deep into the night. Pizza was often ordered late, giving work the quality of a college all-nighter. Ticket sales still needed to be ramped up, Faith told the whole office once at 2 a.m., a slice of pizza in hand. The in-demand, disabled former governor, who was supposed to come give a barn burner at the first summit about sexual assault in the disability community, had just canceled. "It's crazy here," Greer said to Corey on Skype even later that night. "No one can sleep or have a life outside work. We're all basically doing only this." But she was excited, and he could hear it. "Lucky you," he said from his own desk in Manila, where it was afternoon and he was shuffling around papers in the service of companies he didn't really care about. Other people in his office cared, but he didn't, or at least not enough. "I think I'm supposed to like it more," he'd said once, "like you do." Everything, Faith said, depended on the success of the first summit. If it failed, then maybe Schrader Capital would pull out. Though the ticket sales were a problem, the advance press had been impressive, with camera crews appearing at work and interviewers disappearing into Faith's office for a long one-on-one.
On a Monday in March, a little over a week before the summit, after night had fallen and everyone was staying at work as long as they were needed, Faith said she had an announcement. She stood up before them and said, "I know you're all tired. I know you're worn down to the bone. And I know you have no idea how the summit is actually going to go. Neither do I. But I want to say that you are all the best people I know. And you have all been working your asses off. And there's just so long that that kind of asslessness can go on." Laughter. "Without someone having a nervous breakdown. Probably I'm that someone. So I've decided that what we all need is to get the hell out of here." "Right now?" someone called. "Taxi!" "Oh, I wish. Actually, what I mean is that I'd like to invite you all to my place upstate this weekend. There will be food and wine, and I think we'll have fun. What do you say?" It was very late notice, and though it wasn't a command performance, of course everyone would go. It would be like entering a fortress and seeing its mysterious insides. They'd get to know a little more about Faith, who left very few clues about herself. On Saturday, the group took the same train, and then they split up into different taxis and headed for Faith's house. Apparently, there was very spotty cell phone service there in the woods. "Tell your loved ones you will be out of commission," Faith had said to them. Greer's taxi plunged off the main road and onto a small, weedy one that took them past a scrambled mess of greenery and kept plowing through until suddenly the greenery thinned and parted, revealing a pretty brown-shingled house with red trim in the middle distance, with Faith standing on its porch, waving. She was actually wearing an apron and holding a rolling pin, and her hair was blowing. She looked like a beautiful, brave, pioneer woman. Once inside, Greer couldn't even fully take in all the particulars of Faith Frank's weekend house. Objects radiated various degrees of meaning, some of it probably imagined. A maroon leather chair was positioned beside a reading lamp, the leather indented and the dye rubbed off where Faith's head had tilted against it over dozens of years. Briefly, when no one was looking, Greer sat in it, leaning her head back, but though it was no big deal, she leaped up in a moment like a dog that knew it wasn't supposed to be on the furniture. Greer's room, which at first glance was simply a guest room, revealed itself to be something more. Across from the narrow, white, wrought-iron bed stood an old dresser with some knick-knacks on it, among them a small, dusty trophy on which was engraved, "Pee Wee Summer Soccer, 1984, Lincoln Frank Landau, Most Cooperative." Faith's son had spent summers in this room. Now he materialized like a genie from the gold-plated trophy. Even in phantom form, he was a mild threat, giving Greer, a perpetual only child, a sense of what it must be like to have a sibling, or at least what it must be like to have a sibling if you were the child of Faith Frank. You would both be very lucky, except for the fact that you had to share your extraordinary mother. But maybe Lincoln had always felt he'd had to share her. Faith fought for women and girls. "When the world doesn't look out for them, we have to," she'd said. And maybe Lincoln had been in competition with them. And maybe Lincoln had also felt he'd had to share his mother with the people at her job. For even now, Faith was intensely involved with the team at Losi. She went out of her way to call Greer into her office sometimes, or sit with her and a couple of others at lunch once in a while, all of them with paper plates on their laps. She asked Greer about her life, and Greer shyly told her about Corey living on the other side of the world. Faith continued to praise Greer for the speeches she had been writing. Sometimes the women who told Greer their stories stayed in touch afterward, telling her about their lives, a new job, or a setback. "You really bring out the voices of these women," Faith had said recently. "I know we've talked about how hard it is for you to speak up sometimes, but maybe you've compensated, because I have to say, you're an excellent listener. And that is just as important as speaking. Keep listening, Greer. Be like,
a seismologist with a stethoscope pressed against the earth. Pay attention to the vibrations. Here at the house, Faith's voice could be heard in the distance. She shouted something, and someone laughed and shouted in response. Now there was hammering on the door, and then a slightly less loud sound of other doors down the hallway being hammered on, too. Marcella called, "Faith wants us downstairs for cocktail hour and food prep." Everyone appeared downstairs within a minute or two. There were no stragglers. In the kitchen, Faith held up a knife and said, "Who wants to be my sous chef?" And everyone volunteered, their hands shooting up, but Greer's shot up the fastest. "Okay, Ms. Kadetsky, the job is yours," said Faith. "Can you do the onions first?" "Sure." Greer could do onions. They would unflower in her hands. If Faith had said, "Can you solve Fermat's last theorem?" Greer would have said, "Why, yes, I can," and then sat down at a blackboard, chalk in hand, and done it. Faith handed her a mesh bag swelling with onions. Greer positioned herself at the counter, hoping to look like someone who belonged here. A Pinot Noir was brought out, along with hand-blown tumblers of different colors. Greer's was sea-glass green, with little bubbles of imperfection trapped inside like carbonation, and she welcomed the bite of the wine and felt it charge to her head and her thighs at the same time. "Tonight is steak night," Faith announced to the kitchen, and there were sounds of approval. Greer was going to say, "I can just eat the side dishes," but then the subject changed, so she would remind Faith of her meatlessness later. Now everyone began talking about the summit, which would begin Tuesday. "I still wish we'd gotten Senator McCauley," said Helen. "I can't let go of it." There was studious quiet. Whenever the senator's name came up, everyone became a little depressed, almost destabilized. Senator Ann McCauley from Indiana was a powerful force, an anti-choice steamroller, an alarming figure who had done a lot to chip away at women's reproductive rights, and in particular, the reproductive rights of women living in poverty. Despite being in her late 60s, Ann McCauley showed no sign of stopping. "I tried," said Tad. "I sent her office a slavish and eloquent letter. I used all my rhetorical flourishes, but they didn't work." "It would be weird if she did agree to come," said Ifat. "She's no friend to women."
"No, it wouldn't be so weird," Helen said. "She speaks at lots of events. She likes a good debate."
"I swear she's going to try to run for president," Evelyn said. "I know she's getting up there in years, but still."
"She scares the shit out of me," said Bonnie.
Marcella said, "I grew up in Indianapolis, and I remember when she was running for re-election. She had this whole campaign against her pro-choice opponent. I remember there were pictures of fetuses." They talked about abortion rights and the composition of the Senate and about human trafficking, which was a subject Faith felt particularly strongly about, her voice sharpening whenever it came up. And then, somehow, there was a brief side trip into a discussion about a TV crime show from the UK with a hot female character named DCI Gemma Braithwaite, who was beleaguered by the sexism in her department and the violence in her district. Most of the people there loved Gemma Braithwaite, and the entire group, Faith included, quoted aloud a line from a recent episode, which had become sort of a catchphrase.
"I shall take no shite from anyone, sir."
Then they all laughed and drank some more. Helen started talking about women being part of an economic structure so unjust that it could only be fixed by undoing the whole thing. "Piece by fucking piece," she said, and Ben raised his glass. Faith dismissed this. "Even if that ever happened here," she said, "women would still get shafted. Look at Cuba and Venezuela. Women there still aren't equal."
"What's your perspective on that?" Greer heard herself ask. Everyone looked at her. Marcella's mouth was pulled tight, as if she was thinking, "You dunce! Who would ask such an ignorant question?" But no one else looked at Greer like that, certainly not Faith, who was glad to try to answer.
"I think the ideas about what men are and women are, what they essentially are,
go very deep, she said.
That women are subordinate, that women will always be thwarted. These are the ideas that have taken hold everywhere. Sure, there's an economic piece, and that's always been true. But there's a psychological piece, too, and we can't forget it. A few of them nodded, although they'd heard versions of this from her before. Bonnie and Evelyn, who in particular had certainly heard many versions of this, looked happy to hear it again.
I've noted, said Faith, that when people speak about feminism, they take one tack or the other. Our foundation has to look at all of it. We need to keep thinking about the role that economics plays, because no matter how fair a society is, it's still going to be women who have the babies, and that sets them up for housewifery and a double day.
She reached up to a high shelf and pulled down an old salad spinner. Lettuce was rinsed and dumped in, and then Faith yanked hard on the string again and again, as if it were an outboard motor. She kept talking over the din. Even in highly evolved places like Sweden and Norway, women end up doing most of the shit work, though they probably call it something cute, the way IKEA names all its furniture so it sounds better. I have a chair at home named Le Farna, but we still need to see things for what they really are. She let the salad spinner putter to a stop, then glanced around at them. Everyone was listening. And no one had the recessive, tuned-out quality that could happen when groups of people got together and drank.
Bonnie and Evelyn and I are so old, Faith said, that we remember the 60s as if it were yesterday.
Or this morning, said Evelyn.
And let it be a cautionary tale. The women's movement back then had to separate itself from the male-dominated left because, you know what? The left wasn't all that interested in us. My sense is that we're going to be seeing that again. We're going to come up against progressives who will say that women's problems can't be solved under the current system, but that everything will change for women more or less automatically when that system is changed. We're also going to need to show that we support anti-racist work. You know I got Emmett to pour special project money into a reproductive justice group, and also an organization that supports young black women writers, but of course that's not enough. Anyway, I hope our first summit makes a big splash. I hope we make a difference.
They were all silent, and when she was done speaking, Tad said, Thank you for inviting us here, Faith. It's really an honor.
Oh, don't feel that way. I want you to feel relaxed around me.
Faith smiled a peculiar smile, amused at herself, and added, Which is why I drugged all of your drinks.
Faith Frank embroiled in a roofie scandal, said Ben. That would make the news.
And get more attention for loci, said Greer.
That reminds me, Faith said. Someone tell me about the music we've started to line up, because if it were left to me, I'd be bringing in the feminist folk singers I met years ago at Lilith Fair, and that would be, well, very far from ka-ching.
Everyone laughed now, and Helen said, Oh, Faith, you know what? I just love you.
And I love you, too, said Faith.
We got Lil Nuzzle, by the way, Marcella said.
No shit, said Tad. Is it L apostrophe I-L or L-I apostrophe L? Asked Ben. I can never remember.
I don't know, said Greer. He smiled at her, and she smiled back. Then they both looked away shyly.
I'm afraid I don't even really know who that is, Faith said.
A hip-hop act, said Ifat. She's awesome. You'll love her, Faith.
I guess Big Nuzzle wasn't available, said Greer. She looked down at the onions and saw that somehow a pyramid of slices lay on the cutting board. How had she cut so much already? Also, she noticed with some bewilderment that the wine was gone from her green bubbled glass.
As I said, we've got an excellent slate, Faith said. Our naval commander, our activist nun.
I love how we don't even remember their names, said Marcella.
I remember their names, and you should too, said Faith. But not tonight. Tonight we drink wine and eat steak and kick back and chill out.
Greer refilled her glass and looked around at everyone.
thinking then how lucky she was to be here with these people. This focus group of the old and the young, the heavy and the thin, the black and the brown and the white, the gay and the straight, and possibly the bisexual. Though Z would say all of this was a completely reductive way to see people, and probably it was. But tonight, Greer took in the fellowship of everyone here, the famous and the unknown, the bitter, the salty, and the sweet, and even the umami. Faith was umami, in a way, Greer thought, a special and separate taste that once you'd tried it, you wanted more of. As they talked and laughed and drank, Greer imagined telling Corey every detail after the weekend. He liked stories from her New York life, just as Greer liked stories from Manila, where he lived a life in mirror opposite to hers. She already had so much to tell him from this weekend. I stayed in Faith's son's bedroom, she would say, and I imagined what it would have been like to have had Faith as my mother.
Complicated, I bet, Corey would reply.
Yes, definitely complicated. Greer saw herself now as if through Corey's vision. She imagined herself seen by him from the doorway, the light in the room gilded, and then her hand, cutting onions with new, slightly reckless assurance, slipped, and the blade of Faith Frank's knife slid deep into her thumb. "Oh, shit! Oh, shit!" Greer cried, jumping back as though she could escape her own injury. They were all upon her, and distinctly she heard Evelyn murmur, "Look at all that blood! Oh, I'm not good with blood." Everyone rushed around, but no one knew where anything was except for Faith, who calmly took charge, finding a very old, yellowed, tin first aid kit in the back of the drawer beside the refrigerator. "No one has ever left here thumbless," Faith assured Greer, who was so mortified and furious at herself for ruining the moment that her eyes streamed with real tears, not onion tears.
"Really? What about Thumbless McGee?" asked Tad, and the comment was followed by silence, and Tad quickly saying, "Sorry, I make bad jokes when I'm nervous."
Faith turned to them and calmly said, "Why don't you all go take your drinks into the next room? Greer will be absolutely fine. I will tend to her." "Are you sure?" asked Afat, going into assistant mode. "Isn't there anything I can do?"
"I've got it under control. Thank you, Afat."
Faith stood beside Greer over the deep stainless steel sink, where she ran a thudding flow of cold water down upon the bloody thumb and then dried it, keeping pressure on the wound, and then squirted on some antibacterial ointment and wrapped Greer's thumb in a swaddling of gauze and adhesive. The light touch of this powerful woman was profound. So, too, was her choice to use her power in this tender way. Maybe that's what we want from women, Greer thought, as her thumb pulsed and percolated with blood. Maybe that's what we imagine it would be like to have a woman lead us. When women got into positions of power, they calibrated and recalibrated tenderness and strength, modulating and correcting. Power and love didn't often live side by side. If one came in, the other might go. Faith was saying, "Let's keep it like this for a while and see if it stops. Hold it up. Keep it above your heart. I don't think you'll need a stitch." "I can't believe I cried like that."
"What's wrong with crying?" "I think it's underrated," said Faith.
"But right now I feel like a little girl whose mother is fixing her boo-boo. It's so embarrassing."
"Not for the mother.
I remember doing that when my son was little." Faith pushed her hair back from her face and said, "In my experience, the rewards don't necessarily come when you think they will with your kids. And sometimes they come very, very infrequently." Greer thought again of the Pee-wee soccer trophy up in the bedroom and the highly cooperative boy who had won it, now in his 30s and off somewhere else. "So when do they come?"
"Oh, let's see," said Faith. "When they're happy, isn't that what everyone says? Or when they're asleep. Sometimes I was ashamed of how much I liked it when he was asleep. He was a good kid, but it was just so much work.
and at least when he was asleep, I knew where he was and exactly what was happening with him.
And what about now? Greer asked lightly. What's he like?
Now? Now I don't know all that much. His life is his life. He's a tax attorney, and he's very different from me. Not sure he needs me too much, and I never get to watch him sleep. I've decided that there should be a national holiday once a year when grown children have to let their parents tuck them in one more time.
She was silent, and Greer didn't rush in to speak. Faith was revealing herself, opening up, becoming slightly more known. There was a glimmer of mutuality, and Greer didn't want to do anything to discourage it. They were standing together in silence at the sink, by the window that overlooked the dark yard, which was lit with a single floodlight, into which now pranced a deer, as if on cue. It stopped in the cone of light, looking around.
"Ah, my occasional visitor," said Faith.
The deer had one leg tipped up, as though it had been making its way across the grass when suddenly it became lost in thought, maybe thinking about berries or leaves, or about the curious figures of the older woman and the younger one, who stood framed inside a small window. Faith moved slightly, and the deer startled, then dashed away. A little later, after Greer had recovered and was being treated by everyone as if she were a minor heroine, the grill was lit and the question of the steaks came up again.
"I assume that no one has a problem with meat," Faith said. "If you do, speak now or forever hold your peace."
"Your piece of tempeh, you mean," said Afat. Greer was about to mention her vegetarianism, which everyone else knew anyway, after all those times when they'd ordered lunch. But none of them looked expectantly toward her now. Apparently, people never really paid as much attention to you as you thought they did. Having so recently had that moment of intimacy with Faith at the sink, she thought about Faith's apparently mildly disappointing son, and somehow she felt sure that turning down Faith's meat would also be a disappointment to Faith. Greer fervently did not want to disappoint her, so she didn't say anything.
"All right," said Faith. "Even though it's a little brisk out there, I'm still up for firing up the grill. Everyone likes it rare, I hope."
"Yes," came the chorus, including Greer, who surprised herself. Through the window, Greer saw Ben and Marcella mime a quick, flirty sword fight with grill implements. Tonight, probably, they would share a bed, and maybe their lovemaking would even be heard through the walls, to everyone's general embarrassment and awe. The grill smoked and sputtered and began to give off the smell of meals once cooked and now half conjured. At the table, a steak was speared up by a long fork and dropped with a thud onto Greer's plate by Faith herself.
"Voila," said Faith. "These came out well, I think. Hope they're not too bloody."
"Bloody good," said Tad.
Greer glanced with a fixed smile at the enormous slab of steak, which was already pooling in blood, as if it were the head of a person who'd just jumped off a roof. Faith deposited a lump of herb butter on top of Greer's steak, and it immediately spread its arterial death over the stingray-sized surface.
"Dig in, Greer, even with your war injury," said Faith.
"Yes, my stump," said Greer.
"And please, none of you wait for me."
Faith went to tend to the next person. Greer picked up the fork with her injured hand and clumsily held it. She sat with fork and knife at the ready, wondering how she could possibly eat this steak. It was a dark reddish blue inside, unnatural, even perverse. Cool, she had heard that was called. All around her, people were eating and exclaiming. "Oh, my God," Marcella moaned quietly, and Greer imagined her in bed with Ben. "This is amazing, Faith."
"Best fucking steak I've ever had," said Tad.
"You know, Faith, if the foundation doesn't work out," said Helen,
You could open a restaurant and call it Faith Frank's Feminist Steakhouse. Every steak would come with roast potatoes, creamed spinach, and the promise of equality. Greer was the only one who hadn't praised Faith's meat. She soon became self-conscious about her silence and felt she had to contribute something. And every steak at the Feminist Steakhouse also comes with access to the salad bar, she added. Faith, recognizing this was meant to be funny, smiled at her. Greer got busy cutting a perfect cube and then spearing it. Glancing at it in the light, she was reminded of one of those drawings of a cross-section of a piece of human tissue. To eat meat when you hated it, and when you hadn't eaten it for 4 years, was an aberration, nearly a form of cannibalism. But also, she told herself, it was an act of love. In eating this, she was being someone Faith would want to continue to confide in and listen to and rely on, someone she would want to cook meat for. Greer deposited the piece onto her tongue, hoping it would somehow dissolve there, like a sugar cube, but finding instead that it obstinately retained its shape, its integrity, not ceding any muscle or fat. The inside of her mouth was like a slaughterhouse in miniature, with a hint of cedar closet. It was disgusting. Do not be sick, she thought sternly. Do not be sick. Greer tried to reframe the idea of eating meat. Was it really all that different from, say, what took place in sex? In the beginning with Corey, Greer had been both excited and afraid, but soon she was less afraid. Other people, she learned, were not so bad. Corey was just another person, a soul inside a long membrane. He was an animal she deeply loved. Just as this, now, this cubic inch of lost and mournful cow wasn't so bad either. Goodbye, cow, she thought, picturing the distant green blur of a meadow. I hope your short life was at least sweet. She swallowed hard and forced herself not to cough it up. The steak went down and stayed down. Yum, Greer said. On the train platform on Sunday morning, waiting for the 10:04 to take them back to the city and the final days before the first summit, everyone turned on their cell phones again and watched them stutter into service. The phones lit up, the apples popped in, and the Losi team peered with great interest at what they had missed in their absence. They turned away from one another and stalked the platform, listening to voicemails and reading messages. Greer saw with confusion that she'd received 34 voicemails and 18 texts since she'd arrived at Faith Frank's house. It made no sense, but there it was, an extravagant cascade of urgency, almost all of it coming from Manila. Chapter 6. The Ninoy Aquino International Airport at sunrise had an impossibly long line outside the entrance leading up to the metal detectors through which every person had to pass, not just those who were flying today. Corey Pinto, crying for the past couple of hours in spasmodic waves, shuffled in along with everyone else, his eyes burned into little embers. He was trying to keep it together, as people said, but it wasn't working very well. Once he was through the detectors, a voice on a loudspeaker whispered something about Flight 102, and Corey knew he had to move fast. He pushed through the people standing in bunches ahead of him, saying to them, "Excuse me, Makiki Ranpo," but nobody moved. People stood 7 or 12 deep, clutching luggage or backpacks, or in some cases, a loose congregation of boxes bound with tape. Corey had no luggage. He'd forgotten to bring anything. All rational planning had fled from him after the news arrived in the middle of the night. He'd gotten the call, and then he'd stood in the living room of his apartment and said to McBride, his roommate, "I have to go." McBride, whom he had known slightly at Princeton, though they were in different social groups and would never have been friends, looked up from where he'd been half conked out on the leather sofa with its rounded arms and cold, slippery surface,
replaying old missions of Red Dead Redemption on the Xbox that he'd had shipped there from his parents' house when he'd first been hired by Armitage and Rist.
What? McBride said. It's 3 a.m. Where are you gonna go, man?
Music came from his butt-ugly speakers, which always reminded Corey of a housefly's eyes, each one with a round, black, convex circle at the center. Pugnacious's silly rap lyrics played, I saw you sittin' there at the Korean foot spa. I saw you sittin' there with all your chutzpah. Their third roommate, Loeffler, fresh from a finance degree at the Wharton School, was asleep in his room, which always reeked of the cheap weed that he had purchased on a trip to Sagada and riskily brought back for all the roommates to partake of. They were all earning so much money, and while they didn't want to throw it around and expose themselves to danger, they didn't want to be miserly either. They lived in this cushy high-rise in the Makati district, away from the crowded streets, letting themselves rest in the deep, silk-lined pocket where the expats lived and worked and played and spent their money.
Something happened, Corey said flatly. That's about as nonspecific as you can get, said McBride. You want me to guess?
Corey began to cry again, his face corrugating in pain, and of course McBride didn't know what to do.
Help me out here, said McBride. Somebody die back home?
Corey nodded his miserable face.
Like your grandma or something?
He shook his head no. When his cell phone had rung in the night, Corey had sat up in bed and seen his parents' number. It irritated him that they had trouble remembering the time difference between the east coast of the U.S. and Manila. Now his entire night's sleep had been wrecked by the ringing phone. He spoke into it in a tight, unfriendly voice, wanting to convey to his parents that he was grown now, that he had responsibilities and needed his sleep. But his father was crying and saying the most insane thing in Portuguese.
Suamai mato serumau. What?
He must have translated it wrong.
What are you talking about?
Your mother killed your brother.
His father's voice came out in frightening anguish as he told how Corey's mother, backing out of the driveway, had accidentally run over Albie, who had been playing there, unseen. Albie's back had been crushed, a bone breaking off and entering a pulmonary artery. He'd held on for a while, but in the OR in Springfield, he had died.
What? Are you sure?
Corey asked pathetically, raking his hair in the dark, then rubbing his face, trying to find something to do with his now flapping, now flying away hand.
Yes, she did this, his father said. I can't look at her.
Where is she?
Sedated. They gave her a shot.
All right. All right, Corey said, trying to think. Maybe you need to be sedated too. I'm going to the airport now. I'll try to fly out in the morning. It's night here. It'll take me a whole day.
Even as he said this, he couldn't imagine looking at his mother again either. Corey pressed his phone between his hands and then called the airline, sitting and listening to a scratchy brass instrumental version of The Strong Ones that ran in a loop. After he made a reservation, he called Greer, who he needed now in a new, adult way. It was as if he actually thought she could do something. But the call went straight to voicemail.
Where are you? He said into the phone. I need you.
He had never said those words to her. Love all the time, but need never. Frantically, he kept calling back and speaking in a louder and louder voice to her recorded voice, then hanging up. He texted her multiple times, too, saying, call me, but got no reply. There was no way he could leave the news about Albie in a recorded message, no way he could say the words into empty air. He needed Greer to be listening in real time as he spoke them, so that as he exhaled the facts, she would inhale them in a kind of mouth-to-mouth resuscitation.
Call me, please,
he whispered, as if maybe modulation would somehow get her attention.
No matter what time, something really really bad happened. When there was still no answer, he remembered that she'd told him she was going away to Faith Frank's house for the weekend and that she would be out of cell phone range. Faith Frank, who was like a superhero to her. You would think someone as powerful as Faith Frank would be able to get a signal at her house. He paced the small room, which was a stew of his belongings, the waste basket frothing over with papers and empty bottles of San Mig strong ice standing together on the bureau. The whole place was overcome by a general sense of disorder and reek, all of which would be dispensed with by the housekeeper, Jai Matapang, who cleaned up after the three high-paid young Americans who could not take care of themselves. "Boys," she sometimes said, shaking her head when she showed up and looked around the apartment, "always make such a mess." Yet she never seemed displeased. In the darkness, his stomach cramping, Corey slipped out of the drawstring bottoms he'd bought at the Greenbelt Mall and dug into a drawer to find some boxers. Jai took their laundry to a room in the basement that none of the men had ever seen. "Hey, Jai," the three guys always said, handing her their things, and she silently accepted it all, washing their pee and semen-dashed underclothes and ironing their shirts so they could show up looking impressive and confident at Armitage and Rist's office in the Rufino Pacific Tower, the tallest steel-framed building in the Philippines. Corey thought it was entirely likely that he would become a mad person at age 23 and would wander the streets of Manila. Jai would see him out there and would feel bad, thinking, one of the messy boys has become insane. The tall one. Because he had no time to look for anything else, Corey slipped into a pair of black dress pants that were heaped on his desk chair, and then he jammed his passport into the front pocket of his pants and headed out the door. Riding to the airport in the back of a cab with a broken seatbelt that lay uselessly across his lap like a flail arm, he watched as the sedate burble and glitter of Makati receded. He hadn't gotten used to life here yet. From the start, it had been unfamiliar. As he traveled to the Philippines on Cathay Pacific not long after college ended, the flight attendants had welcomed him like a long-lost friend. He lay down and found that he did not seem out of place or like an imposter. Not only that, but his long self seemed not too long for that sky bed, which was like a cradle that rocked him as they crossed the ocean. So Corey Pinto, from Makapi, Massachusetts, ate various pieces of dim sum as well as a minute steak. He ate without worrying about how much he was eating. Life at Princeton had set him up for his new life, which had even started to seem earned, though at other moments he knew that he had earned nothing. Distantly behind him came the moans and discontents of economy class. In Manila, an apartment had been found for him and the others. The building had an absurd name, the Continental Arches. Makati was a wealthy, cushy zone, but once he stepped outside the district, he was in fast-moving Manila, which was its own trip. Most of the people Corey encountered there spoke excellent English, but still he tried to learn Tagalog, because many locals didn't speak English well, and he wanted to not be a snob when he went outside of his little hive. He wanted to make an effort. Once in a while, he and his roommates would go out on the town drinking in local bars and eating cheap meals and dives in a particular area that the orientation materials from Armitage and Rist had specifically warned them to avoid. They rode on jeepneys, those half-bus, half-jeeps painted wild, bright colors and sprayed with graffiti. Sometimes they featured illustrations of devils or eagles and were accompanied by words or phrases like Monster Mobile, or Jesus Loves Me So Hard, or Miss Rosa and Her Brothers. Inside, passengers sat on two long benches facing each other, knee to knee, and were taken on a shockless, bouncing ride wherever they wanted to go in the city. "Bayad po," Corey said nervously the first time he rode one, passing his money forward. Later on, it all became easy and almost natural. Manila had impressed itself upon Corey in light and heavy ways. The wealth that was concentrated in Makati,
the K-9 teams that sniffed around the cars entering the driveways of the top hotels, trunks popped so security guards could look inside with flashlights. The exotica and the twisting extravagance of the foliage, the fish stands and the fruit stands, the fragrant food at even the tiniest little joint, the beautiful children running everywhere, the shocking poverty, and the malls. God, the malls.